session number 24908, Reel 5.
Oh, that's and the next thing, he was flat out, wasn't he? They was piping him to take this blinking landing craft away, you know, and he was under the table.
Do you remember anything about any of the officers on board, or the captain? What was your memories of him?
He was alright. We used to call him Strawberry. It's Sir Aubrey Sinclair Ford Bart. He was a smashing old skipper, he was. But he left in Curie, and because he'd done his time, you know, and that. So when he left, I think it's a tradition that he gets in a car and they put the old like ropes on, like a gun carriage, and then they tow him out. And he was, that's how they done it. That's a tradition, apparently, when they leave the ship, you know, they pull them out like that. They get a car and put the ropes on, you know, and pull him. And it was all on the ship cheering, you know, when he went. Yeah. Then we've got a new captain. He wasn't too bad. But he would. Aubrey was the best.
In what way? Where's that?
He was a jolly old bloke, you know. Yeah, lovely old man.
Any other memories of any of the other ship's company, any of the officers or any of your mates,
something like that? There's only one I can remember. My divisional officer in charge of me was a Lieutenant Jackson. And because I was in the side party, I used to get away with a lot of things, you know. I could always wear overalls, you know, and gym shoes, because I couldn't get over on the landing stage or anything with boots on. And I think it was a little bit of rivalry between us, you know, and I remember when we went up the jungle and when we came back, I fired a rifle on the station. And because when I went back, he said to me, you've got to hand in 10 rounds of ammunition when you get back to the armoury, otherwise you're in the rattle. And I thought, oh God. And we was going back through in a coach and felt someone touch my leg, and I went by that, and there was a bullet. God, lovely. And then when we got back to the armoury, you know, handed him my rifle, and there was a big basin there, and you had to take your magazine off and put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4. And I went 5. And he looked at me. He was amazed, but I didn't know whether it was, when I think about it, I don't know whether it was him sending up a bullet to stop him getting in a report, you know, or whether, you know, one of the lads had filched one, you know, and sent it back. But I think he might have done it to keep his record clean, you know what I mean?
Do you have any memories of the Admiral at that time? Because it was the Belfast was a flagship.
Yeah, it didn't have a lot to do with the Admirals. You know, they used to come on and they'd all be down there, and we had a lot of American generals, Mark Clark and all them, and Sigmund Rhee, and all the big ones come on, but, I mean, that was all down that end, not up our end. We was all up in the forecastle. Didn't have a lot to do with the Admirals. They might get them spat a little bit, you know, but no.
John Rowlatt, Reel 5. I think there came a time when the Belfast was in dry dock in Singapore.
Yes.
What happened then?
Well, the ship was in dry dock. We couldn't live on it, so we was all shifted ashore. HMS Terror, that was a shore base in Singapore, and there was a notice put on the ship's notice board that volunteers were wanted to go up to the jungle to back up the Royal Marine Commandos that was active up in the jungle. And I put my name down and got picked and went right up to Upper Arak. There was about 10 of us in our group got up to the to Upper Perak. There was other groups dropped off on the way at Kuala Lumpur and Kuala Kangsar, and I went right up to Ipo and passed there to Upper Perak. And we was met at the station by a couple of Royal Marine Commandos lorries and took us back to the camp, where we handed in our big Lee Enfield rifles and was issued with the small jungle rifles and given all the jungle kit, boots and hat and everything. And then we spent the day on the butts getting used to the small rifles, which was used for the jungle warfare. Got paired off with a Marine Commando. I was with paired off with a Marine Commando called Clark, called Nobby. And I had to stay with him. Everywhere he went, I had to go with him. We was more or less Siamese twins, so that you didn't get separated or anything. And then when we went off into the jungle to do a patrol, that was the same. We had to keep with him all the time. And we bivouacked at night. We had one poncho for a roof and one poncho to lay on, and we kept together all the time.
And did you encounter any trouble?
No, we was taken to a river and got in. We all piled into big dugout in native canoes and was taken right down the river. We went ashore and there was a Malayan police station, and the officer in charge of the Marines and the sergeant went ashore to find out if there'd been any terrorist activities in the area, and we was told that there was some in a certain area, and we was taken down there and dropped off in the canoe, and then we would we started to patrol, and it was more or less all in line, spaced out behind each other. There was no talking, everything was done by hand signals. And that's how it all started off. And we went for a couple of days without meeting anybody. And we was running short of water. Then we stopped at a tin mine. There was plenty of water on there. And we was filling the water bottles up when the SBA, that's like the Royal Navy medical rating, told us that we couldn't drink that water, we couldn't have that, so we had to find other alternatives, which was an old ditch full of old dirty water, and we had to fill our water bottles up with that, and we had to put one tablet in to kill all the germs in, and then another tablet to take the taste of that away, and that is what we had to do because we weren't allowed to drink the water because he reckoned that we'd all get dysentery because of the tin.
Did you take your food rations with you?
All cold rations it was, because you couldn't make a fire or anything. You couldn't smoke because they said that the natives could smell smoke a mile away, and they say you couldn't talk. Couldn't leave any litter, every little piece of everything had to be picked up, and if you went to the toilet everything had to be buried and everything, you know, put leaves back on it so that nobody could see that you'd been there. And we was going through one night and we had an E-band tracker ahead of us scouting, and he come back to say that there was movement ahead, and we took up defence positions. And it was a patrol of Gurkhas coming through the jungle because we was all getting ready, and it was a patrol of Gurkhas, and you know, had a little conversation to say that they still hadn't found any. And we carried on with the patrol, you know, for the 5 days, and we got back without anything happening.
How did you find the experience?
Quite enjoyed it, really. It made a change from sitting on the ship, you know. But at night it was very, very scary because it was pitch black. And then you had the noise of the jungle, and it was that dark that we all had very fine ball of string, and you had to tie it to your tent, and then that was led to your defence position where there was a brain gun set up, all ready to fire, safety catch off. All you had to do was pick it up and pull the trigger, and then that's how you found your way there, because it was that dark and you had to sit there with your back against there was a tree there, and that was your position. And of course you had them round the camp, you know, your defence positions all the way around, and it was pitch black.
How dense was the jungle?
Really dense, you know, not like you see it on the telly, you know, you had to hack your way all the way. And while you were sitting there, there was the fireflies. And it's just like someone walking through the jungle with a torch, going like that. But it was a little firefly going. And then you'd get a wild pig or something crash through the jungle, and you'd think, what's that? Or a monkey or something would crash through the jungle, you know, jump me through there. And it was a little bit scary, really, because it's pitch black. You didn't know what was going to happen.
You mentioned terrorists. What was the purpose of the patrol?
Well, what it was, when we got there, they did take us round where they'd taken all the villagers and put them in the compound, barbed wire compound. They was in there, they'd got huts and that all built in there, so it was a little village inside the compound. And in daylight, they was allowed to go out and work on their fields and come back in, because when they was living outside, the terrorists was coming and taking all their food. So to cut off their food supplies, you know, they kept all the locals in this compound.
And who were the terrorists?
Well, they was communists. I believe they were the Chinese and Malayan as well.
How long did the patrol last?
5 days, well, 5 days and 5 nights.
And was there anybody else from the Belfast with you?
Yes, there was about 10 in my group that went up to that camp, but we dropped some off as we came up towards it, you know. We dropped them off at Ipo and Kuala Lumpur and Kuala Kangsar on the way up. But when we was there, if you was going along on, you know, they had like a certain time when nobody could move, you know, and if you see anybody moving in the rubber, you could shoot them.
What year was that?
That must have been in Singapore. Now, where did I put it in the art? No, that's got to be in 1952. It's about that time, 50, 51, 52.
After that jungle patrol, did you rejoin the Belfast?
Yes, we had to leave. First of all, they took us for go swimming, and we thought, well, swimming? Well, we're up in the mountain. And when we got up there, we got a lorry to take us up there. And when we got there, we had to chain all our rifles together and left two men standing by them with brain guns, just in case anybody attacked us. And then there was like a stream came down from the mountain and went into a big square swimming pool and out the other end. So it was going down, it was like a swimming pool built in the middle of the stream coming down from the mountain. And because it was freezing cold in there, wasn't it? And we were sweating when we got up there, and we thought, lovely. Because we jumped in we jumped in and out again, you know, it was freezing cold, ice cold water from the mountain. But, you know, once we got back in again, we stayed in there, but not too long, it was freezing. And when we did leave, we was all sitting there, and all of a sudden there was a terrific bang, and the train come to a halt, and we all stuck our rifles out the window to see what was happening, and then Lieutenant Jackson come along, you know, and said, you know, we've been derailed, and keep your heads down. But I'm just waiting there, and I thought, well, nothing happened, so I decided to go. I had a camera with me, so I was walking up the track taking photographs, and of course Jackson come and shouted at me, get back on the train, you know, what do you think you're doing? And then he sent me to me and John Lucas, he sent us to the guards van to guard the rear of the train. And we got in there, and I can always remember there was these metal cases with all films in. They were sending them back to the cinemas in Singapore, and we piled them all up at the back of the train. It was like the old American ones, you know, where they got the rails around the back, you know, like a little platform, and piled them all up there, and we was waiting there and looking up the track. And while we was doing that, they was tapping in onto the telephone line to let them know that we'd been derailed, you know, and they was going to send another train up from the other end to pick us up. And we started hearing these bangs, you know, explosions like, and we thought, what the hell's that? And we could see someone walking down the line. So we was getting a little bit dubious, like, but what it was the Green Howards. They'd been told that we'd been derailed, and as they was coming down the track, they was mortaring the jungle each side as they was coming down. And they came down, you know, right up to us and stood around while we waited for this train to come from the other, from Kuala Kang or Kuala Lumpur that way. And they was like open back trucks, what you see, and we all got into there, you know, jumped into them and came back. And I did have a photo, I took a photograph of the other lads there, but there's someone who's doing memories of the Belfast, and he's got all the original photographs what I sent, you know. He did have them done on the computer, but they said the publishers that were doing the book said that they can't really print the ones that have been done on the computer. They wanted the original, so I've had to send them all, and he's still got them. I shall be getting them back Easter.
Presumably all that happened on the way back from the patrol,
yes,
didn't it?
Yes. Going back to the ship, yes, after we'd done the patrol, yes.
What happened when you got back to Belfast?
When we got back to the Belfast, we sailed for Hong Kong, and we had all extra stores, ammunition and stores and that, all packed in the waist of the ship. And as we was going, after we left at night, and we was having an exercise. There was a submarine and motor torpedo boats was going to attack us. So we went to action stations, you know, and the ship was all blacked out. And there was a Nafi canteen assistant, a young lad, he came out onto the deck, and it was pitch black. Because he knew his action station was forward, and he was aft, and he was trying to find his way forward, and there was all these boxes of ammunition there, and because he was feeling the boxes, and he was going along, and he came to the torpedo tubes, and he thought, oh, because they're always trained fore and aft when we're going along, the action stations, they're trained out, you see. And he came along, and he felt the torpedo tubes, and he thought, oh yeah, they're fore and aft, because he followed them along, and splash, he walked over the side, didn't he? And Ronnie Paul, my mate, my shipmate, he saw him because he was closed up in his action station with his headphones on, you know, and he just glimpsed him, and he shouted out over the microphone, you know, man overboard, man overboard. And they said, man overboard, man overboard, what do you mean? And he said, effing man overboard, man overboard. And then, because all the lights come on then, and then the skipper, he done a special name for it, a something turn. He went along, and then he turned right round and came back on the same opposite course to where he was going.
A storm turn.
No, I've got the name of it in a book upstairs somewhere. And he came back on that course, and because they had all the oldest lamps on, we called the lifeboat away, and the sea boat's crew went, dropped the other boats, you know, and we picked him up, and he'd only learned to swim while we was in Singapore. We picked him up. That was a little bit of excitement. Ronnie Paul, if he hadn't have seen him, that would have been his lot.
What happened to the exercise?
I forget now. I can't remember. I don't know whether we still carried on or not, but I mean, you'd give your position away, you know, or switched all the lights on.
Any other memories of the Belfast?
Oh, not that I can think. I know, can't really think of them at the moment, no.
Would you say the Belfast was a happy ship?
You wouldn't find a happier ship than the Belfast. And you asked anybody that served on it, you know, that was the happiest ship they've ever been on.
Why do you think that was?
Well, I think it was such a long time that you was together, 2 years. 2 years you've been together and you had to get on, you know, and you all relied on each other. You know, you couldn't, you know, oh, no, I ain't going to do that. You know, it was teamwork. And everybody, you know, I think we was dead lucky, you know. It's a long time, 2 years, and especially when I go up there now and I look at the size of the mess that I was in with all them blokes, you know, and I think, my God, how did I live in that for 2 years, you know, without going round the bend?
When did you leave the Belfast?
I left the Belfast in 53. Yeah, I left on the 22nd of January 1953. And then I joined the Corona.
What sort of ship was the
Corona? She was a destroyer.
And where did you go with the Corona?
That is the one that went up to the Arctic doing the experiments with the paintwork and the different greases for the guns. We used to go pick out the worst weather, steam it full speed into it, and then afterwards you'd go around and check the paint. There'd be strips of paint, and there'd be the name of the whoever produced it, you know. Same with the grease. We'd fire the guns and see if the guns would still fire, you know, whether they jammed or froze. And then we'd go around and look for a bit more rough weather, you know, and see how it went. And it was quite rough, you know. You can just imagine it steaming in it. And we was testing out cold weather climate. And I was in the director. And it was an open front director, and because the wind was coming in, and I had goggles, a sealskin hat, and a suit. It was like a big padded boiler suit, but I had it plugged in. It was a little electric heated suit, and testing it to see what it was like, you know. It was all right, I'd say, and we all had got issued with big heavy coats. And I told you, it's the same as the Belfast, you know, we used to have the woolen long johns and leather sea boots instead of the rubber ones, you know, and tested all the different things out. Gloves, mittens, tried them all out. And you couldn't shave, because if you shaved and you went out on the upper deck, with the cold weather, it cracked your face. So everybody had to stop shaving. And then we had a competition who had the best beard afterwards, you know. But, yeah, it was a bit cold.
Whereabouts were you doing the tests?
In the Arctic, up in the Arctic Circle.
Whereabouts?
In Iceland.
Tell me about getting to and from the Arctic.
Oh, well, the one was a little exercise to get there, and we had to disguise ourselves as a merchantman. We had to put some canvas up, you know, so that we could try and break the outline of a warship. And we had to put another mast up where the gun turret, for a gun turret was, you know, so that it was another mast. to see if we could sneak through as a, you know, a merchantman instead of a destroyer.
Was it the Russians you were trying to fool?
No, it was all British submarines and motor torpedo boats, or whoever was chasing us, you know. But I think we managed to get there all right. Yeah.
Life on board a destroyer must have been very different. It's a smaller ship.
Much smaller, yeah. And you get chucked around a lot more as well in heavy weather, which we did because while we was on there, the Queen flew to Canada. And it was a 9-foil scour. We was out there for a week on position, getting chucked all over the place. And then because it was so bad, she decided to change the flight route to fly to Canada, and we had a 200-mile dash to get to the new position in case it crashed. And all the best swimmers on the ship had to get their names down in case it crashed. They had to tie themselves together. This is what happened if it crashed. That the best swimmer in the front and then the others behind it had to swim to the plane with an axe and then try and chop themselves in to try and get them out. God knows I expected them to do that, but that's what we trained and that's what we were sent to do. And we were stationed right across to Canada.
Is that always the case when the Queen flies abroad?
Well, I don't know what it is now, but I think we've done that on two occasions. Well, I don't know whether they still do it.
How did life on board, day-to-day living conditions, compare on the destroyer with life on the Belfast?
Well, much different, you know, because you've only got to get a bit of rough sea on a destroyer and you're all over the place. All your dinner used to fly off and all the plates would come off, especially if you had some real heavy weather. And of course, you'd stick a nose in and you'd get all the heavy seas crash down on top, and you used to go like that, sitting in eating your dinner, and you'd be going like this. And then if you was on the stern where I was on that one, she used to stick a nose down and she'd lift the stern up out, and the propellers would have no water there, so they'd spin and it'd rattle like that until it bumps down in again, you know. It really gets you shaking, you're up. Yeah. Can be very frightening.
How did the size of your mess compare to the mess of the
Belfast? Much smaller. I reckon the one on the Belfast, you could say that was a big mess to what it was on the destroyer. And that was the first one that had to put bunks round. Only just one, like you had a load of lockers, and then on top of that they'd put bunks. You know, they'd put like a mattress on the top. But hardly anybody liked to get in the bunk, you know, because when you rolled, although it had a piece there to stop you rolling out. But no, you prefer the old hammock because, you know, that was going like that and you was all right. You might go down like that, but no, they didn't like the bunks. But of course, they've got no choice now, have they?
Was the mess system the same as on the Belfast in terms of food?
Yeah, same. Although some, I wasn't in it, but they used to have one. It's where you used to do all your... look after yourself, all your own cooking, take all your stuff up. I mean, they give you the meat and that, but you have to take your own potatoes and veg up. And you was allowed so much a week per person. And the more you saved, I mean, they wouldn't have, they used to say, destroy breakfast is a cup of tea and a woodbine. You didn't have any breakfast because that was more money going in the pot. And then when you came in after doing a cruise, whatever money was left in there, which you hadn't used to buy food, you all used to go ashore on a booze, you know.
So all each mess ashore. Would be allocated a sum of money?
Yeah. Each man was allotted so much money, you know, and then you had to buy whatever you needed out of that. So the more you economised on that, the more money you could put in the kitty.
Who would be responsible for buying the food for the mess?
Well, you'd have, I suppose, the killing of the mess, more or less. He would... decide what you was going to have, you know, and then you'd be the cook and you'd have to do whatever it was, you know. But
so food had to be cooked separately, did it?
Yeah, yeah. You always like cut you peeled your own potatoes and that and veggie and take that out and the food, get the meat, and then you'd have to bring it back and dish it out yourself.
Where would the cooking be done?
In the galley. You'd stick it in the galley, what you wanted. And you also have a tin lid. And if you put potatoes in, you'd put them in like a netting. And you'd have a tin lid with your number of your mess knocked in. You know, like if you're 30 mess or 12 mess. And then when you went in there, they'd put them all in the big cooker. Cook them all together, you know, and get them out. And then if you went up there, you said, you know, 12 mess, you'd look on the tin and see what the number was. So there's just spuds there, you know. And if you run out of spuds, you know, you're eating too much, at the end of the week, you'd go without potatoes, you know. So that you could have, you know, you might get, say, well, we'll have a tin of corned beef. All the more money you save, you say, at the end, when you finish the cruise, you got more money to go, sure, and have a good booze up and go to the pictures or do whatever you like then. But that was a bit, be all right if you was on a diet, I suppose, that way.
Any other memories of that ship?
Well, on there, you didn't have a laundry. Like on the Belfast, you had a laundry. You could send your stuff to the laundry. The Chinese used to run it. And, you know, a lot of stuff, if you didn't want to do it yourself, they'd do it all for you, but, you know, but you had to pay. But normally, you know, you want to scrub your hammock, you've done it yourself down in the bathroom, you know, or you do your own dobing in a bucket if you wanted to, if you wanted to save money. You know, or you could send it there and it will come back pressed and ironed, you know. But on a little destroyer, you didn't. You used to do your dobing in a bucket and go down and hang it in the boiler room to dry, you know, and bring it up and iron it. You used to go and get an iron and do it all yourself.
What you've talked about doing these experiments and testing various paints and things out. What are other duties did you undertake on the destroyer?
Well, more or less just the upkeep, as I told you, go up and keep the ice down, you know, didn't want to get too much ice up on the rigging and that, with it going at high speed, you know, you're getting more spray up on the deck and more the ice was freezing, you know, even though it was salt water, still freezes.
And how was the ice removed?
Just go around and bang it with something, you know. Just kick it and shovel it off the deck and shovel it over the side. That's more or less what it was.
And which sort of ports did you visit during your time in London?
We only went into Spitsbergen to get some fuel, that's all. And we called in Stavanger and Oslo as well. Called in a couple of ports on the way back, you know, just to go ashore for a drink and that.
How did the recreational facilities compare with Belfast?
Didn't get a lot, really. No, you didn't get much time, you know. Could hardly get a football team up or anything like that. I mean, what we normally, I used to do was go sailing. One of the Killicks, you know, he's... He used to go and ask if they could get a whaler, right? And about five of us used to jump in a whaler and then go for a sail, you know, go for a sail round. And we went to Casablanca on it. And they went ashore in the whaler, but it was a bit, they didn't realise. They went ashore, good, yeah, but when they went to come back, there was these great big rollers, and because they couldn't get through them, so they had to send the ship's motorboat. They moored there, you know, that they were stuck there, and they sent a motorboat in to, you know, to pull them off because they couldn't get through these big heavy surf rollers coming in. Every time they started to get away from the beach, they'd get, you know, rolled back again.
John Rolat, Reel 6. You mentioned Casablanca a moment ago. How long were you in that part of the...
We was in there for a week. About a week in Casablanca, yeah.
Did you spend much time in the Mediterranean?
Used to go to Malta and Gibraltar quite a bit, yeah. Exercising with the Home Fleet, you know, if the Home Fleet was doing an exercise, we'd go into there. And used to go into Gibraltar and of course you could go across into Spain, but a lot of the time there we couldn't go over because apparently some British sailors went over there and the palace guard, they've got like skirts on, and apparently they went and debagged them, and they stopped all the British servicemen going over there for quite a while. But you could go to the British Army barracks there, and they would let you change in their barrack room in the civvies, and then you could go across into Spain and come back again, but you couldn't go over there in uniform.
How did the discipline on the ship compare with the Belfast?
Well, I think all discipline on